So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe. Meine Lieblinge, Wildlachs in Scheiben, je 80 Gramm Packung oder Lachs in Scheiben, je 100 Gramm Packung, nur 3,29 Euro. Oder Le Rustique Camembert, französischer Weichkäse, je 250 Gramm Packung, nur 2,79 Euro. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, Kat. How are you doing today?
I am doing very well. Continuing to plug and look through Dragon Quest XI.
Oh, good. Good for you. You've done your homework.
Yes, I seem to have found Frozen.
I think I know the region you're talking about. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I just remember, like, the first time I went there. Like, I'm traveling along, and I see this pond, and there's this big frozen black dragon in the pond. I'm like, oh, that's cool. I'm sure that's not relevant to anything that's going to happen later in the game.
I'm sure that I'm just waiting for Let It Go to start playing as a soundtrack on loop. It could be one of the other five songs that are playing at all times on Dragon Quest XI.
Well, it'll be a change.
Yeah. I like Dragon Quest XI for the most part. I managed to defeat a giant octopus. That was very cartoony. And he actually wasn't too bad, ultimately, once I figured out the trick and the party composition. I think the thing that's interesting about Dragon Quest XI is that I feel like I kind of am incentivized to rotate in all of my party members, kind of like Final Fantasy X.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely like every character has their strengths and weaknesses, and a lot of the bosses you encounter will like take advantage of those.
It seems like Jade and Veronica are better against regular enemies, and Silvando and Serena are the best against bosses.
Yeah, Silvando I found is extremely invaluable against bosses because he's got a lot of the debuffs and the buffs, and he has a really good healing attack called Rab has Rita's Ring, but I think Silvando has the Hustle Dance, which will heal your party for some HP, and that's really valuable to learn.
Yeah, I got Hustle Dance against the painting. I needed to restart that painting battle a couple of times because it was taking control of different party members. And if it took control of Silvando, I was kind of in trouble because Silvando was my main source of party healing.
Yes. And one thing about status effects in Dragon Quest games is they are merciless. Like, this isn't the kind of game where someone falls asleep and they get hit and they wake up again. No, they wake up when they're damn ready to wake up.
Yeah, it's my observation that the RPGs that unlock party healing the earliest are usually the easiest, and the ones that are really stingy with healing tend to be a lot tougher, and Dragon Quest XI definitely. It gives everybody kind of healing, but not very strong healing.
Yeah, it's definitely like single healing for quite a while until you get to a little bit later in the game, and even then you have to know exactly who gets what. It's not like, say, like Final Fantasy VI, where you have like minute control over what your party members learn.
Well, I mean, in Final Fantasy VI or whatever, you can just be like, oh, I'm going to heal my entire party every time, because you can choose single target, or you can choose to dilute a spell by choosing the entire party.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember when I was young and I was playing Final Fantasy VI, and I realized just how much easier it was compared to the Dragon Quest games I grew up with, because I was like, holy moly, you can multi-target cure spells? That's insane. It was pretty insane.
All right, we got a lot to cover, including a console in which Dragon Quest did not appear, the Nintendo 64.
Poor Nintendo 64.
Yes, we're going to be talking about the rich RPG legacy of the Nintendo 64. It didn't have a rich RPG legacy.
Spoiler alert, did not have anything. Well, it had a little bit, we'll talk about that.
We'll also be talking about all of the Pokemon news, including DLC for Pokemon Sword and Shield and the return of Pokemon Mystery Dungeon. But first, Axe of Blood God is a U.S. Gamer podcast. If you're enjoying the show, why don't you leave us a review? You can do so on iTunes or Stitcher, or I think Spotify, though I'm not sure. If you like us on Spotify, maybe give us a like. I think that's how it is. Or
yeah,
follow
please do.
Us.
I think we are on Spotify.
Follow us on all of the things.
Please do.
If you have a comment or you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter at @_catbot. Nadia is at Nadia Oxford. Send me a DM. Send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net. Leave a comment on the show notes on the site. We may read your comment on the show. We also have a newsletter that goes out every single Wednesday, courtesy of one Nadia Oxford. Nadia, what was the topic of the newsletter this week?
Well, this week it was freezing cold for a while there, so I started to think about tropical locations in RPGs, and I thought about how there really aren't that many. Of course, Sun and Moon, Pokemon Sun and Moon is a good example. The example I brought up was Chrono Cross, which, to my knowledge, entirely takes place on a tropical archipelago. And it's really nice how it's just surrounded by, like, warm blue waters, and I think about it a lot when it gets cold. I actually had someone write to me, reader Hao Tran, who said, there is a sequence in Suikoden 4, which I never played, where your party can get stuck on a desert tropical island, and you can, the way they put it is, you can resist the but thou must dialogue options until your friends relent and you get a sort of bad ending where you all just live on the island forever. Funny thing is, the ending isn't a cutscene. The game just continues, playing as normal. You just can't leave.
So some other games that had tropical locations, Pokemon Ruby and Sapphire.
Oh, that's right. Gosh, that's that goes to show how much of an impression Ruby and Sapphire made on me, I guess.
Because it was set on basically Okinawa, and the result was a lot of water travel, infamously.
How could I forget? Oh my god. I've only been to Tokyo, so I find it fascinating how Japan is such a tiny island, but it has so much climate, like, variations between the regions.
I have been to Okinawa, actually, and it's a really cool island.
So it's kind of a tropical location?
Oh, yeah. It's basically like Hawaii.
Nice.
It has its own unique history, and actually kind of tortured and controversial history, which I won't get into, but it's a unique place. And they definitely have, I feel, maybe their own identity or their own cultural identity, much in the same way that Hawaii has its own cultural identity. So another one, I think Final Fantasy X is pretty, pretty tropical.
Oh, you got a point there. Everyone just sits around in the water all day and plays Blitzball.
I mean, Waka is very, like, symbolic of whatever their take on is on island culture.
See, I have yet to play X, so I don't know what their take is on island culture.
Well, you should play Final Fantasy X. Maybe make it your project this year.
Yeah, I'll play Final Fantasy X and write an essay on what they think about island culture.
We could do a Final Fantasy X report, since we've already done Final Fantasy IX.
Yeah, that makes sense. Why not just go to the next one in the sequence?
Yeah, make it a part of the console RPG quest. If you're interested in a Final Fantasy X report, shoot me a note. I would be curious, because I really enjoyed our kind of deep dive discussions of Final Fantasy IX. And what else did we talk about? Oh yes, Chrono Trigger was one. And I also assigned you Persona 4. Yeah, that was
fun. Yes, that was fun. And you should finish 7.
I really should. But I don't know, like, every time I pick up my Switch, like, Dragon Quest XI is the one that is kind of my go-to.
That's fair. And I mean, the remake is coming out very soon, so you may as well just start from there, I suppose.
All right, let's continue on to the news this week, which was around Pokemon DLC. So Pokemon Sword and Shield, it's starting in June, and then again later this year, we'll be getting two large expansion drops. It'll be part of an expansion pass, which I believe in total will cost $29.99, or is that $29.99 for each?
I think it's each.
Okay, because that's pretty steep if that's the case.
I'm not 100% sure on that, but it's still highly preferable to buying a whole new game with very little new stuff.
Counterpoint, Pokemon games used to cost about $29.99.
Did they? I just remember, games were always expensive up here, so I don't remember paying anything less than, say, $50.
GBA games were, you know, between $29 and, like, $35, and Pokemon games were always a little more expensive than that. And they always stayed full price. They never went down.
Yeah,
I remember being in Japan and looking at Pokemon Ruby, Pokemon Sapphire, and Pokemon Emerald, and they were all the same price.
Oh, wow. So I did get Emerald.
I felt really bad for anybody who got suckered into buying Ruby and Sapphire over Emerald.
Yeah, like, Emerald was a huge improvement over Ruby and Sapphire.
Oh, like, gigantic. I mean, it was the comprehensive version, and it wasn't particularly close. But mm-hmm. it also like Ruby and Sapphire were very flawed in their own ways. But so so it is a little steep if it is an expansion pass for each one, or if each expansion is $29.99. But on the other hand, they are giving us a lot of content, entirely new area, tons of new Pokemon, mm-hmm. New legendaries, seemingly a new quest line in which you have a new rival and you're being trained up by a new character. So in that respect, Pokemon fans are basically getting their third version, except as DLC, so you don't have to play through the whole story again.
Yeah, and I'm actually really, really eager about that, because one thing I didn't like about the old games and having to buy a whole new game is just going through all these story points again. And they usually change the story points, but in a couple of cases it was for the worse. Like, I really think they neutered Sun and Moon's story with Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon. And, so I just like the idea of buying an expansion that is pure content that I have not seen or experienced. And given how there's actually quite a gap between the packs, I think one comes out in June and one comes out in fall or winter, even if it is $29.99 per, it's going to be such a space that I'm not even going to think about it.
For me, it really spoke to the difference in character this generation is going to take on, because traditionally each generation has been kind of this discrete ecosystem, I want to say, in which each game has its own region, its own character, and its own monsters that really kind of take center stage. And there will be games that come out that generation that also highlight monsters from that. Interestingly, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, for example, was a fourth generation game and had a bunch of fourth generation characters as a result, kind of leading the way, as it were. And and they would have tie-ins to the main games often that would kind of enhance the sense of interconnectivity. I remember when Pokemon Diamond came out, one of the games made it possible to unlock a legendary, and that was kind of the only way that you were able to do it, though I had somebody trade it to me, so I was like kind of unlucky on that front. But this one seems to be much more of a Pokemon Sword and Shield are the platform, and everything else stems through that. So we're much less likely to get spin-off games. And I would even say that remakes of Diamond and Pearl might actually be kind of unlikely.
Yeah, some people were expecting that this Nintendo Direct that we saw this week was going to be an announcement about Diamond and Pearl remakes, but that...
I didn't expect them.
Yeah.
My understanding was that there wasn't going to be any new Pokemon games, or that's... It just doesn't seem like there would be any new Pokemon games this year, you know?
It doesn't make sense, not if they're working hard on the DLC, because, I mean, we'll probably go into it, but there is there's a lot of content coming, like they're restoring 200 of the Pokemon that got locked out of Galar region, for example.
Yeah, and there was immediately a misconception about it, where people were talking about it being stuck behind a paywall or whatever. It's like, it's not really stuck behind a paywall. I mean, you can access it by trading. If you have Pokemon Home, you can transfer all of your old monsters over, so...
Yeah, and, I mean, they said that, like, very clearly, and within the presentation. It's not, like, a piece of information that came out later, oh, by the way. No, that information pretty much followed the announcement about the 200 new Pokemon, and just people decided to hit Twitter and get angry about something that wasn't true. What else is new?
I mean, per usual, there's a lot of misinformation kind of floating around, which is why we did a news story about it. We did see that the legendary birds are apparently coming back, which is exciting, I guess, if you don't have them already.
Well, I just love the designs they have for them. I'm really curious about Moltres. They've really changed the way Moltres looks, kind of has like a hooked beak. And I love the fact that I'm getting the impression that Zapdos is now a kind of a chocobo or a cassowary, where it has these enormous, huge legs, and I think it might be flightless. And I think that's a really cool design change.
Articuno's always been my favorite of them.
Yeah, I was never a huge fan of Articuno, to be honest with you. I always liked Zapdos and Moltres.
Articuno was the first ever legendary I caught. So if you'll recall, in the original Pokemon Red, you'll be going through the islands, or the caves, or whatever. Uh-huh. And you come out, and you just see this bird standing there, and you have no idea what it is. You have no context whatsoever. And then you go into battle in it, And you already have the Master Ball at this point, and I wasted my Master Ball on Articuno.
Did you, like, throw, like, 50 Ultra Balls at Mewtwo when it came time?
Oh, yeah, I caught it with Ultra Balls.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because I'm awesome.
Yeah, like, I didn't know that was possible.
But Articuno, I did not know about legendary birds or anything. So without context, it was a really cool and surprising moment, right? And you got
that
this
would be
very strong Pokemon. And the first Link battle I ever won was against my friend who rocked this really strong Blastoise who would always kick my butt because I picked Charizard. And so I brought out Articuno, and out of sheer dumb luck, I froze it. And shipped the Blastoise down to zero health and then finished off the rest of his team. And I don't think he ever beat me again.
You destroyed his confidence as well as his Blastoise.
I destroyed his life.
You destroyed, you ruined his life, Kat. No, Articuno was great, though, for that particular generation because, if I'm not mistaken, ice types were a little bit OP in Red and Blue.
My favorite thing was to fake out. I learned how to fake out people with switches. So I like figuring out double switches or predicting when somebody was going to switch to counter and hitting them with the right attack. And Articuno was a great way of luring in opponents. I thought I was so awesome in Pokemon Red.
I was going to say you were like the Pokemon Patton.
Yeah, I was awesome, except that I didn't know anything about Pokemon battling in Pokemon Red, because this was a time when you could fool yourself into thinking that you were awesome because the internet didn't exist. Or it existed, but it was a very nascent form.
Yeah, and then you like met your first like online, you did your first online battle, this first iconic online battle, and got destroyed.
Yeah, well, my first online battle ever was in like 2002 or something like that. And I had no idea what was going on with the new items or the new IVs or whatever. So I just picked some strong-looking monsters from the original generation and the new games. And I remember I put Choice Band on one of them. I think it was Absol. And I was like, well, this will make his move stronger. And then I was like, oh. And then I started using Swords Dance. And then I discovered that I couldn't stop using Swords Dance. And then I got swept.
The person you were playing here with against must have thought you were on drugs or something.
Well, I had no idea what I was doing, but I quickly learned the ins and outs of Gen 3 battling, and that became a large part of my life for a couple years there. But with the expansions, I haven't actually finished Pokemon Sword yet because, like I said, I've been kind of knee-deep in Dragon Quest XI. But with Pokemon Home coming out, that is exciting news for me because that means I'll be able to transfer over some of my favorite monsters, and then I'll be able to kind of run the rest of the way through the story and start doing some of the post-game. I intend to go and capture a whole bunch of legendaries in Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon that I've missed. I never ended up catching the rest of the legendary three whatevers, the Tapus or whatever they were called.
Yeah, I never did that, to be honest.
I don't care about catching them all these days. I only care about having a running collection of legendary monsters that I keep as trophies. So
I only care about catching the cute ones.
Well, I mean, I think this is a series that you gotta set your own goals with.
Pretty much, very much. That's why Pokemon is still so popular, because you can do pretty much anything in that regard.
So yeah, I've got a little bit of a time limit. It was sort of like when Pokemon Bank support was coming for Sun and Moon. I ran through and I got all of the ribbons that I possibly could in Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire before moving on back over to Sun and Moon. Because once you transition them, they can't go back.
Oh, that's right. No, they can't.
So any thoughts on the DLC and or Pokemon Home, Nadia?
Pokemon Home is honestly not something I'm keeping close tabs on because I'm not someone who transfers her old Pokemon from game to game. But I am looking forward to the DLC very much. I am glad that we saw in the concept art they were showing us for the DLC that Nidoran is back, which means Nidoking is back. And Nidoking is by far one of my favorite Pokemon ever. I just think he's got such a cool design, and I'm glad he's coming back. I'm very interested in the second expansion pass because I kind of like the idea of exploring a tundra, and just going by the outfits that they have for the characters, I almost get the impression it might be like a search and rescue sort of thing. And I don't know if that's true or not. I do know that you get to go inside the monster lairs the Dynamax layers from Sword and Shield and just kind of encounter legendaries there and explore the layers. And I think that's pretty neat because when I see the layers in the vanilla game, I'm like, what the hell are those and where do they go? So now we will find out.
Once I get to the end game, I might indulge in the raids a little bit more. But I mean, I have to get to the end game first.
Yeah, the raids are actually quite a bit of fun, especially once you finish the game.
I've been meaning to check out how the metagame is going on Pokemon Showdown and maybe get together a team and see how I feel about it, because I always at least dabble a little bit.
Yeah, one thing I need to get more into is the same thing, learning about how the metagame is going, because by all accounts, it's actually going very well. People really like the rental teams, and they really like the fact that, frankly, the Cull has really wipe the slate for a lot of people and freshen things up, although I guess once the Pokemon start trickling back in, that won't be the case as much anymore.
Well, Rotom Wash is still meta, but Gengar is apparently underused now, which it's a strange time.
That is very strange. I didn't know that about Gengar.
Gengar was always uber strong, but
yeah.
But then they took away the fact that it was invincible to ground attacks, so
yeah, that'll nerf it just a bit.
Just a bit. Before we move on, any thoughts on Pokemon Mystery Dungeon? Any interest in that? I mean, I really like the graphics.
I really like the design they went with. They kind of like a little bit of a storybook watercolor design. I think that's really nice. I have never played a Mystery Dungeon game, and I'm excited for this one because this will probably be enough to finally get me interested in the series. I just never picked it up, never went into it. But I feel like now that I understand more about I can't remember if it's like a dungeon crawler or a roguelike or whatever, or both. But I just remember not being so enthused about the genre that it was part of back in the day. And now I've kind of expanded my RPG repertoire, so I might appreciate it a lot more than I would have in the olden days. So I'm thinking I'll download the demo and give that a try once I have time.
I always give it a try and end up not liking it.
Yeah, at least you give it a try, though.
I know that Parrish, who is a big roguelike guy, big Shirin the Wanderer fan, never really cared for Pokemon Mystery Dungeon. I think he considered them to be too simple or too easy.
Yeah, I could see why they're not exactly going to like make NetHack for kids.
No, they should. Break them.
That would be...
Break those kids. Make them realize what's in store for them, what life is really like. That's what roguelikes are all about.
Yeah, they sure are, and that's part of the reason why I don't like them very much.
Life isn't fair. Sometimes you put on the hover boots, and then you just can't reach a water source, and then you die of thirst. The irony.
Oh, the irony of it all.
Okay, and you put this in the notes, and I guess this is something to promote. We started a new series. It's called Remember When. And this is of interest to Blood God readers. It's about when the Xbox 360 tried to conquer Japan, and it resulted in some interesting RPGs, including the Tri-Ace games like Infinite Undiscovery, Tales of Vesperia, Blue Dragon, and it still has some effects because Tales of Vesperia, for example, never came out in the West on PS3 because Microsoft kind of threw its body in front of it. And there are certain games that are still only ever available on the 360, including Blue Dragon, though you can play them through Xbox backward compatibility. So go check out that article. I enjoyed writing it. Got a pretty solid response, and we'll keep doing those.
Sounds good. Yeah. We've talked a little bit in the past about Xbox's, Microsoft's attempts to woo the Japanese consumer, and it was a very good try, but it just did not work out.
All right, Nadia, that's it for the news. So let's continue onward to the Nintendo 64 console RPG quest. Okay, continuing onward with the console RPG quest, we're wrapping up the 32-bit era, or shall we say the 64-bit era, with the final console to be released in this period, unless you count the Dreamcast, which was kind of its own in-between. It was kind of a tweener, but...
It really was a tweener. It was a preteen.
We'll get to that one eventually, but the Nintendo 64, or as Nintendo 64 kid would say, Nintendo 64!
Nintendo 64, oh my god! That poor kid. I wonder if he's still... I wonder if he's living that down yet.
Nadia, what is your history with the Nintendo 64?
It was definitely the first system that I saved up for and bought for that generation. The PlayStation followed much later when I realized, oh god, this is not the system for RPGs. And it sure wasn't. But I definitely enjoyed it for other things. It was really the start of, if you want Nintendo's games, you have to get their systems, that sort of, you know, credo going on. Because Mario 64, of course, was brilliant. It reinvented the 3D platforming genre. Ocarina of Time was brilliant. It reinvented Zelda. It had, like, smaller, you know, more pleasant games, like... I can't even recall off the top of my head that's the kind of system it was. It was definitely a system for, like, Mario and for Zelda. It did have Majora's Mask, of course, which was pretty excellent. It's funny, thinking way, way back to the days when I was saving up for that system, I was thinking I was doing it not only because I love Mario and Zelda, but also because I love Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy. And back then, of course, we associated Nintendo with Final Fantasy. We associated it with Dragon Quest, and... that turned out to very much not be the case anymore once that generation got underway.
Yeah, I remember when Nintendo was starting to promote the Nintendo 64 through venues like Nintendo Power and everything. And I remember looking at the screenshots of the 3D characters or Mario and Luigi and everything standing on a 3D cityscape and thinking, well, that looks dumb.
I remember those screenshots because, god, that was in like GamePro, one of the 1993 issues. That was one of the first issues I ever bought, actually. And thinking, wow, that looks kind of weird.
They were promoting their big partnership with, Silicon Knights or...
No, Silicon Graphics. You're thinking
Silicon Graphics. How they had these giant workstations and they were making it out to be such a big deal. And of course, because I was such a Nintendo fangirl, I bought the propaganda hook, line, and sinker. Though, behind the scenes, and this is evident in... there was a really good, long... retrospective about the development of the GameCube, and apparently things that between Silicon Graphics and Nintendo weren't so great, honestly, so that really hampered them a lot. I, like everybody else my age, was super excited for Nintendo 64 when it came out. I don't remember being that excited about Mario 64, actually.
I liked it a lot, yeah.
Because I didn't really get it.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I mean, it was this big kind of 3D, fully explorable world and everything. And I was like, oh, I mean, that's really cool, like a cool proof of concept. And being able to manipulate Mario's face is really neat and everything. But I don't know, like this isn't like standing out to me. Maybe because it's more puzzle oriented and more traversal oriented and figuring out how to get all of the stars. And I've always been much more of a straight ahead platformer fan.
Ah, that makes sense. One setback that I did suffer when I bought my N64 is that our TV was ancient and it didn't have AV ports. Hmm. It just had that crazy RF switch, whatever the hell you're supposed to do back then. And a friend of my brother's, who I've still talked to now, had to come over and help us set up. And the first thing he did, he was the first one to play the damn system. And the first thing he did was he takes Mario. He starts spinning him around again and again, yelling, "I'm on crack, I'm on crack, I'm on crack." And I never forgot that.
I did not own a Nintendo 64. I asked my parents for one, and they did not buy me one.
you should divorce your parents, Kat.
I remember getting up in December 1996 and sneaking out to the car where I knew the presents were in the trunk, like in the dead of night, and like looking in there. And being like, N64, N64, N64. And it was a VCR. And I was a spoiled white suburban kid. I didn't really know it at the time. And I was just like, oh, VCR.
A VCR in like 1990. Wasn't the VCR like practically on its way out by then?
I mean, not really. It's the
N64. I guess not.
VCR was still having its heyday. It was cheap enough that you could gift it to a kid.
And, oh, okay. So I thought like it was for your family. It was for you.
Yeah, it was for me.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and I was able to tape DS9 and Babylon 5 episodes.
That is better than N64, to be honest with you.
Because it was the mid-90s, after all. But yes, my friends did have N64s, and we played a lot of party games at their houses, and that's primarily how I engaged with it, and that's, I think, primarily how it's remembered these days, aside from the Nintendo exclusives, was it was a pretty happening party machine between Mario Party, Mario Kart 64, you know, Super Smash Brothers, which came out on the Smash for GoldenEye. Oh my God, we have played so much GoldenEye; it was ridiculous.
Yeah, we used to. They actually, not myself, but like people I went to school with, used to actually bring the N64 and GoldenEye into school on Fridays and just play it in the media room.
And there was N64 mania in 1996. It was the hottest.
There was.
It was the hottest thing, like that, and Tickle Me Elmo. Like they were just impossible
what the hell
to
was
find.
With that? There was. It was to the point where that was a year I got surgery for something to do with my jaw. And I was lying on the table, like, ready to be anesthetized. And for some reason, we're talking about, like, what do you want for the holidays? Oh, I already have an N64. It's like, wow, where do I get one? This is the freaking anesthesiologist putting a needle into my arm.
Yeah, it seemed like all of my friends except me had one. But it meant that I got to go and play the latest and greatest games. So that was fun. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
The one that truly blew my mind and I loved and still is probably one of my top five favorite games of all time was Star Fox 64.
Yes, that was a great game. That was I got that for my 17th birthday. That was I really enjoyed that.
I appreciate all the more today. Like at the time, it was 1% a letdown because I didn't like the music as much as the original Star Fox.
Yeah, that was the one thing that I didn't like about it so much.
But now I really like the music and the set pieces are awesome. And of course, the voice acting was mind blowing and the rumble pack.
It was. When I listen to the voice acting now, I can hear how compressed it is, but it was still pretty great.
Yeah, so that was the one big game. And then, of course, a couple years later, Ocarina of Time came out. My friend got it day and date. And I didn't see him for the next couple weeks because all he wanted to do was play Ocarina of Time.
I don't blame him. I was pretty much the same way.
I remember not being that impressed by Ocarina of Time when I first saw it.
Yeah, neither was my husband. He was just not an Ocarina of Time fan.
Yeah, I saw the graphics and I was like, eh. And that was the thing. Like, I think the Nintendo 64 for the time when it first came out, games like Wave Race 64 and Mario 64 and Star Fox 64 looked awesome, right? Mm-hmm. And then a lot of other games did not look so awesome.
Yeah, you really had to know what you were doing with the N64. And I remember the first time I realized, okay, this is not going to be a system full of pretty games. Is around the same time in the arcades is when Dungeons & Dragons Shadows Over Mystara came out. And I was really, really huge into that game in the arcades. And I remember going on my school's BBS and talking like on the video game group, like, hey, is there any chance Shadows of Mystara is coming to the N64? And everyone was like, probably not. But it's coming to the Saturn.
They were making a big deal of the arcade releases that came out in like 1995 or thereabouts. Games like Killer Instinct, which I played a fair amount of and remember thinking, wow, this is like the future. Look how amazing this game is. Or Cruising USA.
And they both eventually came to the N64 and were severely compromised.
Oh, Cruising USA was terrible on the N64.
Oh, it was garbage.
If you think about that now, like, can you imagine a Nintendo, basically a first-party game, wasn't it? Coming out on Nintendo, on the home console, and it being terrible?
It would not happen, no.
Yeah, and then Killer Instinct was the same way because it was made by Rare, wasn't it?
It was Rare, and the problem with Killer Instinct Gold, it wasn't a bad game, but that controller was so terrible for fighting games, it was nearly unplayable.
Yeah, and then they also had, like, Mortal Kombat, the Sub-Zero Chronicles or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I asked my parents, like, you know, I was sick one time and I asked my parents to rent me, like, Killer Instinct Gold, and they brought home that, and I was so mad.
That was our first real taste of the Nintendo drought because, I mean, we had, at the early going, we had Mario 64, Mario Kart 64, Star Fox 64, and then there was a lot of nothing.
There was a lot of nothing until Zelda came out, yeah.
I mean, in 1997, we got, like, GoldenEye, Star Fox, and Diddy Kong Racing. And Diddy Kong Racing was basic. Diddy Kong Racing and GoldenEye were basically the tentpole games. That was it for 1997, and they had to go up against Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, it was a bit of a bad time for RPG fans like myself.
Yeah, I think this was around this time Quest 64 came out, which was
oh god,
Probably the most infamous example that everybody always points to is the failings of the Nintendo 64's RPG library. The Nintendo 64, well, I think we've already kind of mentioned it, did not have a lot of RPGs.
We might have made that point once or twice.
And Quest 64, there was a lot of expectations around it for some reason. Maybe because it was a game for the N64, so any game that came out on the thing was going to get a lot of attention.
As I recall it personally, it was just the only thing we really had to hold up against Final Fantasy VII. It was like, it's how dumb I was at the time. Like, people were like, oh my God, Final Fantasy VII, the demo is incredible, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, well, we're getting Quest 64.
Was it as bad as everybody said?
You know what? I have never played it, but it's, if nothing else, like, at the very least, at the very best, pardon me, is mediocre.
I mean, yeah, the graphics really don't stand out. The real-time turn-based combat is very simple. It super does not hold up, and it wasn't that great for the time. It just wasn't very deep. And
exactly.
I think RPG fans who are coming off the Super Nintendo, I mean, I think that was a rough blow, right? I mean, to see what the N64
really
was putting out versus what the PlayStation was coming out at the time.
Even, as you say, from the Super Nintendo to the N64 was just a humongous step down. You're talking about going from Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger and even Super Mario RPG to that.
Yeah, it was definitely the awkward adolescence of game development in general, where you're going through the very peak of sprite development to whatever the heck was going on with 3D development on the Saturn, PS1, and Nintendo 64. And I mean, there were some good examples of stylish-looking 3D games. I think Metal Gear Solid actually holds up surprisingly well.
It does. Yeah, I agree with that. I just think because it's so cinematic and Kojima did a lot of really neat things with camera angles that
it helps
hold it up.
Well, it was insanely ahead of its time. It was also a game where nobody had facial features.
Yes, and something like that actually helps it age a lot better.
Yeah. The Nintendo 64, I think the popular kind of discussion around the N64 is that it failed because it didn't have CD. But and that at least is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Because there just wasn't enough memory, producing cartridges was a huge bottleneck, a huge problem. Sony did a great job of wooing away third-party developers who were sick of Nintendo's BS when it came to licensing problems and everything with Yamauchi. But if you look at the Nintendo 64 from a technical standpoint anyway, it was kind of fatally flawed in many ways. The way that the processor worked, it couldn't really access memory properly. Games were, like, super slow. You had to do, like, all kinds of technical workarounds just to be able to make things work properly. There's this quote from Chris Sutherland of Rare who said, "From a software perspective, we push the memory of the system very hard. As you move the camera around the map in Banjo-Kazooie, the machine is constantly throwing out of memory things you can't see and pulling in the scenery that appears into view. This gave us major memory fragmentation issues. We used a proprietary system that reshuffled memory continuously as you played to eliminate the fragmentation. I doubt many N64 games at the time did anything like that. Overall, it meant we could dedicate a higher number of polygons to the characters and backgrounds than many other games at the time managed." So basically, these developers were having to come up with their own proprietary tricks and workarounds just to make their games look even halfway decent on the dang thing.
And that explains why Rare was one of the very few companies that could make games that look good on that system, along with Nintendo.
Yeah, so I think that, sure, the cartridge issues were definitely a big thing for RPGs, but, I mean, games even just in general looked not great on the Nintendo 64, even for the time. They looked inferior to the PlayStation.
For the most part, yes. And it's just Nintendo and Rare, maybe, who could really make the games look good, but their writing was on the wall from the very start, because if you read the oral history of Final Fantasy VII by Matt Leone, basically it says outright that Square Enix, or Square at the time, told Nintendo, "Hey, your system kind of sucks," maybe not so many words, "but we can't do what we want to do with your system, even without putting the CD issue to the side. Your system just does not work as well as the PlayStation system does," and Nintendo told them to go fly a kite. So that was the problem right there. Not just, there was, number one, the cartridge. Number two, it just wasn't an easy system to program for. Number three, Nintendo was very arrogant and thought, well, we're Nintendo. You're going to develop for us anyway. And guess what? They didn't develop for them.
Yeah. I mean, Square at the time was basically Nintendo first party. Like, yes. It was as close to Nintendo as, say, I don't know, it was almost Naughty Dog to Nintendo, yeah. Right?
I would say it was even closer now like than Nintendo and Monolith Soft. It would be like Monolith Soft saying, hey, screw you.
Yeah.
We're not working with you anymore.
I mean, Square obviously was not actually a subsidiary like Naughty Dog and Monolith Soft, but it was as good as. Like, they had a special relationship with Nintendo. So to break that, and it never recovered. It's never been the same. I was reflecting on that just recently when all of the Final Fantasy games, like 7, 8, and 9, and 10, and 12 finally came out on the Switch. I was like, oh my God, this is like the first time.
It really is, isn't it? And I was thinking how like Cloud's appearance in Smash still blows my mind. When I look back at that trailer, I'm like, it just feels alien to me. It feels like something that should never have happened.
I mean, Square has traditionally been a company that really pushes graphics and everything. And like Nintendo at a certain point after the GameCube era just stopped prioritizing that stuff at all, right? And instead it became much more, and so Square, you know, supported the handheld systems, but it was always with kind of secondary releases. Like The World Ends With You, as much as I like it, would never, it was more of an experimental thing. It wasn't a blockbuster release.
Yeah, and same with the Crystal Chronicles, which was, again, kind of a four-player thing. You had to hook up your 4GBAs to play, pretty much.
So, yeah, like, Nintendo 64 was really kind of screwed for third-party support. And a lot of that, and it kind of really hurt it in Japan. Supposedly, like, it sold horribly there. It sold horribly in Europe, too. And it's kind of insane to think about that the N64 actually sold a lot better in America than any other territory.
Yeah, I didn't know that for a very long time. And did you fall for the thing with the Silicon Graphics workstation examples that were you like they made like they recreated part of Final Fantasy VI using that, and the magazine said, "Hey, this is Final Fantasy or 64 or whatever." Did you fall for that and think that was actually coming out like I did?
No, I wasn't paying attention to RPGs that closely at the time. So
I was paying very hard attention. I was very convinced it was true.
They kind of reported it that way, didn't they?
They did, and because, you know, like, it was so much better in the magazine days. Everyone was so not corrupt.
it looked bad. Like, you look at the screenshots, and it looks so much worse than the original game.
And yet, it looked like the way that the games ended up looking like on the N64, it looked fantastic.
So, why did RPG developers shun the Nintendo 64? I think we laid out the reasons. Pretty much, it was selling poorly in Japan. Nintendo's old-fashioned licensing practices drove them a lot of them away. Severe memory problems, sound chip problems. Sony throwing open the doors and saying, "Come on over." And plus, we were obsessed with cinematic at that time. Mm-hmm.
Well, they were pretty cool for the time, and that was one huge detriment on the part of the N64. Like, I think I've said it before, but one of my biggest memories is looking at the, you know, going in front of game stores that day and just watching the capture of the FMVs and stuff, and for like Mega Man 8 and Wild Arms and the really cool anime stuff they had going on. It was really, there was nothing else like it back at the time.
Yeah, FMV, we put a huge premium on them. It felt like a big deal when you were watching an FMV cutscene.
It really did. It felt like you were getting your money's worth.
And so you couldn't do that on the Nintendo 64. And then you also had, I mean, the Final Fantasy VII had a kind of a MIDI soundtrack and everything, but by and large, the PlayStation sound chip sounded a lot better than the N64 sound chip, which was kind of muffled.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Another thing to the advantage of the PlayStation is that the PlayStation could easily distribute demos for their games, including Final Fantasy VII, and there was huge hype around that demo. N64 couldn't do anything like that.
I remember in my school, the general consensus was that the PlayStation was the system that you wanted to get for all of the best games, and the Nintendo 64 was a party system, but that it had very clearly fallen behind the PlayStation. This was the gossip in the hallways of Metcalf Junior High School.
Straight from gym class.
So, I mean, but there were RPGs, a few of them.
Yes.
One that tends to be forgotten, Super Robot Tyson 64 that came out. on. So Super Robot Wars even made it onto the N64. There's also Super Robot Spirits, which I think was more of a different kind of game. But Super Robot Wars 64 was a traditional SRW game. And you can kind of see the difference between it and the PlayStation just in the way that they approach it. On the PlayStation, they were starting to get much more toward where the series would be today, where you would have like really elaborate animations and a really, really nice soundtrack and voice acting and all of that stuff. And if you look at the N64 version, it looks like they take the Super Nintendo sprites and kind of move them. They put a Super Nintendo sprite against a 3D background and kind of expand it and make it smaller. And the sound chip sounds really muffled. And it seems like they did everything they could with it, but it's maybe not. Maybe there's a reason it's not remembered very well.
The way you describe the graphics sounds really horrible.
It doesn't look good, honestly.
It
actually could be a lot worse. The sprites are in some ways surprisingly good, but I mean, the N64 not really known for sprite work, is it?
No, we had. Gosh, I'm trying to think. I was going to say Mischief Makers. That wasn't a sprite. It was a side scroller. But same with Yoshi's Story. It wasn't sprites. It was models. Oh gosh, there really aren't that many sprite based games on the N64.
I mean, if you're going to make a game for the N64, you're going to make it 3D, right? Because that was kind of what it was.
That was pretty much all it was really good at, if that.
If you look at the N64, once the shine wore off, it started to feel really kiddie as a system.
Yeah, and I remember, I think it was Parrish pointed out years and years and years ago how you could just tell by the way they released that Pikachu N64 with the button in the foot.
I mean,
it was for kids.
Yeah, and then Pokemon completely exploded at this time. And
right.
Any other time, Pokemon should have been front and center on the N64, but it really wasn't. It was a Game Boy series, and the N64 only ever got spin-offs. So that certainly did not help it in its later days, right? Where
No.
I mean, the games that we got on the Nintendo 64 were Hey You Pikachu.
That never. If you ever watched people try to play that, it's hilarious because it doesn't work.
Full of all sorts of really dumb. I mean, it was just one more example of an accessory because it was a microphone, I think, that you used to talk to Pikachu. There was Pokemon Stadium, which was a much more traditional, and Pokemon Stadium 2 was actually a really good-looking game and really fun to play and everything, but when Pokemon Stadium came out in Japan, it didn't even have all the monsters.
Yeah, I remember. I think our Pokemon Stadium is their Pokemon Stadium 2, and yes, it has. They had to release it again, so it had all the monsters in it, and this was back when there was 151 monsters, so...
They really went all out with Pokemon Stadium 2, though, where you had the Game Boy Tower, where you could basically play the Game Boy games through, because you had the little pack that plugged into the controller, where you could plug in the game, and not only did it access your team from the actual Game Boy game, but it actually let you play the game on fast speed as well, which is kind of cool.
And it had that is pretty cool.
All kinds of really fun challenges and everything that you could access. It was really fun to battle all of the gym leaders. It had a fully 3D Pokedex and all of that. And so for the time, Pokemon Stadium 2 was really neat, but it was only ever a companion game.
Yeah, it actually makes me wonder how things would have been different for Pokemon if, say, the games came out while the N64 also proved to be a humongous hit. Would Game Freak have jumped over to the main consoles that much more sooner instead of, just this generation?
I don't think so, because Game Freak has always put a big emphasis on shareability. And
that's true.
That meant handhelds.
Right, with the link cable and all of that.
One game that was cool, it wasn't an RPG, but it was RPG-related, Pokemon Snap, which I think...
Yeah, I never played that.
Oh, it was fun, where they put you on a 3D rails, basically, and you would try and find ways to get Pokemon to do special things. You were trying to lure out monsters and get excellent shots of them, and it was really tough because you were on a minecart that was always kind of moving, and so... I played a lot of Pokemon Snap, and it was a really enjoyable game. I desperately wish that they would make a new one for 2020. Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have been asking for Pokemon Snap 2 since God, years and years. And when the Wii came out, sorry, the Wii U, everyone was like, oh, here it comes, and never came.
I think that the correct approach to take with a Pokemon Snap game is a fully 3D open world game in which you can just wander through these gorgeous environments, luring out Pokemon and getting pictures, and your sole goal is basically to enjoy this beautiful environment, complete challenges, and try and level up to the point where you can eventually take pictures of legendary monsters.
I actually like that idea a lot. That would be a lot of fun. I'd love to play that.
So that's my pitch. So Pokemon was a big deal, but ultimately, while it was certainly, they did their best to connect it to the Nintendo 64, ultimately it was a Game Boy Color game. And that just goes to show where the N64 kind of stood at the time.
Yeah, it was not exactly at the top of the heap.
But some actual real RPGs for the Nintendo 64. There was Ogre Battle 64, which, I mean, it's not like Tactics Ogre. It's more of a high-level strategy game, actually.
Oh, okay. I was thinking like, oh, okay, it's Ogre Battle 64. It's just, you know, Ogre Battle. But no, I never played 64, so I'm not sure.
So in Ogre Battle 64, you're trying to conquer these strongholds, right? And when you push an army out and then they come back in. So it's more like a kind of a strategic thing rather than going through these like super winding political tales. Like there's definitely that look and that feel to it. And it's kind of sprite based. It's kind of a 3D sprite, a little bit like Suikoden.
Right.
And the way that you set it up is that you have these heroes and then the heroes have armies behind them. And then a lot of it is very hands-off. So you're more of a general than somebody who is actually, you know, controlling these characters.
Right, right. So it's funny. When you think about N64 RPGs, you kind of have to think of outside of the RPG box because so many of them are just like, it's kind of an RPG, but not really.
Yeah, that's the thing is that, like, so many of these games really are outside the box. They're kind of real-time, turn-based games. Like, people are citing Hybrid Heaven, which
I don't know about that. I don't know that one, Prime.
There was Mega Man Legends. Would you consider that an RPG?
No, absolutely not. I love Legends, but no, the most RPG you're getting is that your stats are kind of there when you change and upgrade your weapons. That's about it, but not even.
Paper Mario came around, and that was the legacy of Super Mario RPG. And yet it was definitely RPG-ish, very RPG-light, but there was a turn-based component to that one.
There was. When you say RPG-light, you're not off the mark because, you know what, I never played the original Mario, Paper Mario. I love Thousand Year Door, but it's the same thing where you have Mario and you have, I think, one party member. And even though it's basically very fast-paced battles, and I guess I would still go ahead and call it an RPG, because, yeah, you are leveling up and all of that good stuff, but it's, you know, compared to, say, on the PlayStation, where you're having, like, Suikoden 2, like, these six-party battles through this, like, winding road of political intrigue. Not quite like that, but definitely stands up on its own for what it is. I absolutely love the idea of just kind of pairing up with, like, Mario's traditional foes and making party members out of them, like, oh, Mario's traveling with a Goomba. Oh, Mario's traveling with a Paracoopa. That kind of stuff I love.
And definitely the most beautiful, N64 game.
Yes, by far. I remember people being a little bit mystified when it first came out, like, what the hell is this? But no, it's not a coincidence. That is the game that holds up most of visually of all the N64 games.
So stylized. I'm really impressed that Nintendo was able to pull that off on the Nintendo 64's hardware.
Yeah, I think there's like articles that have been written about what they did and the tricks they used, but yes, I am absolutely. I think one of the reasons they went with that whole style is because they knew of the N64's limitations by then, but they still wanted a game that looks good, and they got it.
And they certainly did. And Paper Mario kind of continues to exist to this day, though it's more of a second tier or third tier Nintendo RPG, I would say.
It's not even an RPG anymore. It's more of a
platformer-ish thing.
More of a platformer, yeah. I think the
Wii version definitely turned it into more of a platformer.
Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the Wii version, and Color Splash just came out. That was more of an action game. But Sticker Star, I think, is when people started. If you say the word Paper Mario Sticker Star, you'll get a chorus of people cursing Miyamoto, because supposedly he said, why does an RPG about Mario need a story? And they took it out. But some people really, really, really hold a grudge against Miyamoto for that.
Well, that's kind of like what happened with Mario Galaxy, right? Where they were really at odds over whether or not it should have a story. And one of the main developers kind of got his way. And I think that Mario Galaxy is the better for it, actually.
So do I. I actually think the storybook, not only is the storybook gorgeous, but I think the story is very nice. I mean, there's a reason why Rosalina is everyone's favorite.
I think one thing I want to kind of point out about this particular era of RPGs is that we are coming to an end of a period in which there was a clear delineation between RPGs having stories and then everything else, right? Where mm-hmm. the arcade era is slowly changing, because this was in the U.S. at least, this was about the time that arcades started to die. And
right.
This was the beginning of the end for arcades in North America. And Nintendo and Sega always drew really heavily on arcade heritage. So genres like shoot 'em ups, beat 'em ups, that kind of thing, started to fall off around this time and started to be replaced by blockbuster games that would actually have stories. And that would become a lot more evident in the next generation, for sure. But this was kind of the last period in which there was that clear, blocked-off period where it's like, okay, you have RPGs, which have really good stories, and then everything else.
Gosh, yeah, it was around that time when arcades... because arcades got kind of a second chance at life because of DDR. That was a huge, huge thing. And fighting games, yeah. But I think it was first the fighting games, then DDR. And once DDR died out, it just... arcades have never really come back since then. So, yeah.
Because if you think about the 32-bit era... lots of platformers, right?
Yes.
Where you had Mario 64. PlayStation was putting out stuff like Banjo and Spyro, and those games didn't really have stories, you know? They had mascots. They were mascot games.
Yeah. And of course, Mario 64 didn't have a story either.
And, I mean, you think about some of the best PlayStation games outside of the RPGs, like, they didn't really have stories, not too much. It wasn't until the PlayStation 2 where that started to change. But yeah, this kind of marks a pretty clear break point, I feel, where things began to change and story became less of a clear marker. Though RPGs would tell much more complex stories often than a lot of action games, for example.
Yeah, but I think you're right about that, because I have noticed that pretty much every game has a story these days, to the point where you come across a game that doesn't have a story, and you're like, wow, this game just gets to the point, doesn't it?
And games like Last of Us, for example, have a very emotional and like pretty good story that cribs directly from The Road, but that's neither here nor there. And that's not an RPG by any stretch of the imagination, right? Same with mm-hmm. Breath of the Wild to some extent. Like, just every game has a story now, for the most part.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, heck, Modern Warfare has a freaking story, if you can call it that. So RPGs are much more about turn-based gameplay or how you build up your characters and all of that stuff. I mean, the story and the choices that you make in the story versus just having a story. So I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about some of the RPGs that did not happen.
And there were a few.
The one that really comes to mind is Earthbound 64, which was kind of a whole dang thing with the Nintendo 64 DD, the disk drive, which was one of Nintendo's many attempts to try and create a peripheral that would give Nintendo 64 expanded abilities. And I got to say that, like, anytime you're in a situation where you're specifically putting on peripherals designed to expand the capabilities of your system, and you're splitting the fan base that hard, you're going to have some trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, especially since the 64 DD was planned, like, long before the system even came here. So I think Nintendo knew from the start, oh, man, I think we're in trouble. Either way, the 64 DD did not take off. You will find some YouTube
Came out in Japan.
YouTube videos.
Never came out
here.
It
came out in Japan, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Like, you will find some YouTube videos of people in Japan playing, like, Doshin the Giant, which actually looks like a pretty interesting game. but for a while there, it looked like RPGs were going to be on the 64DD and everything was going to be okay. But that didn't end up being the case. I guess much like the Famicom disk system, the games intended for the disk ultimately wound up being on the on cartridges anyway, or just outright canceled. And I think you're probably going to bring up Mother 3, which, yeah, was a whole thing, as you said. Mother 3, I remember reading about it in magazines and being a little bit confused because I really wasn't into Earthbound then. I never bought it. I didn't play it until years and years down the road. And it was all credit to Ape and Shigesato Itoi. It looked pretty terrible graphic-wise, like a lot of things on the N64. If you look into the history of the game, though, now, if you go to Starman.net or a million other places that have it up, it's really, really interesting because a lot of what was canceled in Earthbound 64 eventually wound up in Mother 3 on the Game Boy Advance. So when I kind of compare screenshots and information between the two versions of the games, you see a lot of cut content. Like, you still see a lot of parallels between the content, like certain characters, certain locations. You still have the character of Flint. You still have the character of Lucas and Close. You still have the dog, Boney. You still have certain towns. So, and I think even much of the plot involving Porky and the Chimeras was intact. So I really liked looking back and seeing what stayed and what went. I think Earthbound 64 was originally supposed to put Flint as the main character, whereas Mother 3 makes everyone kind of the main character for a while until it settles on Lucas. So there are definitely some differences. Like, we see screenshots where Lucas is hanging out with Close, who, of course, disappears, quote-unquote, very early in Mother 3 in the Game Boy Advance. So, yeah, it's a pretty cool history. Go back and read it sometime if you can. But the long and the short is they just could not hack programming in 3D for the N64 because the system was pretty much a loss by then.
Yeah, I always thought it was interesting that it was going to be a little bit similar to Donkey Kong on the Super mm-hmm. Nintendo before getting shifted over to the Nintendo 64.
Yeah, it was definitely, I think it was definitely a little more action-based, although there was some screenshots of the turn-based battle system. So there were still turn-based battles there.
Somebody who played a tester who supposedly played the demo cart and then also worked on Mother 3 claims that we aren't missing anything. There isn't some lost Earthbound game out there that ultimately this long, long process culminated in the creation of Mother 3. And that was the end point of all of that.
Yeah, by the sounds of it, it was maybe 30% complete. Itoi said, or 30%, I think Miyamoto said 60%. There was no way it was 60%. It was more like a kind of a handful of ideas that they put together for demo videos. And of course, you had some rough story outlines and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't think we're missing very much.
I suppose that I was always a little surprised that RPG developers didn't take advantage of the RAM expansion. Which yeah. came out in like 1999 and was like a big part of Rogue Squadron, for example, really helped with the memory issues that the system had. But then again, I suppose by that point, they were all just making games for the PlayStation, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, I think by that point, it was a little too late. I had the RAM expansion for Donkey Kong 64, which is funny because the only reason the RAM expansion was there in Donkey Kong 64 is because the game kept crashing. Rare had no idea why. They could not figure it out. And for some reason, putting the RAM expansion in made the problem go away. Never figured out why, but that's why it was there. And I remember it most for Majora's Mask. And the reason I remember that is because Ocarina of Time, its main problem in my eyes was that its overworld was dead as hell. There were no enemies on there except at nighttime. You got like a couple of skeletons coming up and chasing you. But I remember being really impressed with the overworld of Termina and how it was really filled with enemies. Like, you had like slimes, you had Dodongos, you had like just birds getting up on your grill. It was a very lively place. And I'm actually, like, one thing I was actually a little bit angry about when Ocarina of Time came out on the 3DS was that they didn't upgrade it so that there were some dang enemies on the overworld.
I think it says everything you need to know about the N64's library that Ocarina of Time is consistently listed as the best RPG for it.
Exactly, yeah. I'm looking at the list of RPGs for the N64, and it's like Ocarina of Time. It's like, I have to give it to you because I have nothing else.
It's not an RPG, though.
No, it's really not. There's very little that's RPG
about it. It's a game about solving puzzles.
It's an action-adventure game. It was very interesting because it was our first time solving those puzzles in 3D. And I remember being, like, I think that's what really enthralled me about the game was you had your traditional, like, for example, in the first dungeon, you had a traditional torch-lighting puzzle. And just solving that in 3D for the first time, it just blew my tiny little mind.
Blew my tiny little mind.
Pretty much.
I think the most irritating storyline in gaming today is people saying that Ocarina of Time is overrated.
Yeah. Here's the thing. There are other Zelda games I would rather play in the here and the now, but as a game that... As a game that just is a footnote in gaming history, like, it is one of the most influential games of all time, period.
Yeah, not only is it incredibly influential, it holds up. It's a surprise. It's an amazingly huge game that came out for the N64. They truly went all out. It has really good dungeons. Like, the Forest Temple is outstanding and gigantic.
Forest Temple's still one of my favorite dungeons of all time. I complained about the overworld. I still think it's really boring, and at the time it was incredible because, oh my god, a horse. But the dungeons, I don't have too many complaints about how the dungeons are, except, well, even the Water Temple I managed to do as a kid back in the day, but yeah.
The design is so intricate, and the graphics are kind of hold up surprisingly well in kind of a stylized way, especially the final battle against Ganon looks awesome
cool.
And actually still looks pretty cool. The way that Link progresses and develops. Ah, man, and they did all that on the Nintendo 64. It's amazing.
Yeah, you're right about the way the game looks, it being definitely one of the better looking N64 games, which by today's standards, that's still not great, but... the models and the lighting effects, I think, are really nice. I would say don't look too hard at the rendered at the backgrounds, because if you look at the Lost Woods and some of the trees there, not the polygon trees, but the kind of the tree JPEGs they have in the background, like they look pretty terrible. But otherwise, the enemy models are still pretty great.
And they fixed the dang they solved the problem of 3D targeting. Which wasn't really a thing. Like, people didn't know how to interact in 3D space with objects. And Nintendo's like, oh, well, create a targeting button. There you go.
Yeah. And it
made combat
still
feel great. Like, they created that.
I still get mad that there were games after Ocarina of Time, like years after, that did auto-targeting instead of giving us a Z-targeting. Like, you people, like, what is your problem? Nintendo solved this problem. Why aren't you taking their idea?
And there's so many elements of Ocarina of Time that remain iconic to this day, like the Temple of Time. Like, we were kind of ragging on the sound chip, but it had that beautiful kind of Gregorian chants going on in there. Or like when you pull the Master Sword for the first time and the way the camera turns.
That's cool.
And you see pretty good lighting effects. It's surprisingly emotional, especially when you're dealing with the Kokiri. And
the Kokiri, yeah.
Who seem kind of doomed, and it's a sad story, but it works really well within the story. The scope of it is incredible. I mean, wow, Ocarina of Time, I don't think it's the greatest game of all time, which some people have said, but...
Yeah, some people think that, yeah.
Good Lord, I mean, it was a game, and it was the magnum opus, I think, of like Nintendo up until that point. They went all out. They put everything they had into it. I certainly think it's better than anything that came out after it up until probably Breath of the Wild.
Like in terms of Zelda games?
Yeah, I think it's better than Wind Waker or Twilight Princess or Skyward Sword, all of which were fairly flawed.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I am probably one of the only people who really likes Twilight Princess, but... It built on what Ocarina of Time did, just to give an idea of how important Ocarina of Time was to begin with.
And Majora's Mask, like, really brilliant game, and I know that there are people who stand behind it, like, as a great offbeat, super experimental, but, I mean, it was built on the platform established by Ocarina of Time, ultimately.
Which is perfectly fine. Like, yeah. I know that Breath of the Wild 2 will probably end up being the same way, where Nintendo's just taking... this engine they obviously put so much time and effort into and saying, hey, let's have another game in there. It's like, that's perfectly fine with me.
All right, so let's look back. What is the legacy of the Nintendo 64 when it comes to RPGs, if any? And what is the best RPG on the Nintendo 64?
Oh, God. So we just had this whole conversation about how the legacy of the RPG on the N64 is, RPGs that aren't really RPGs. Zelda, there you go. Zelda's not an RPG, but we don't have much to go on here.
The legacy of the Nintendo 64 is the breakup of Square and Nintendo when it comes to RPGs.
I totally agree with that. That was the first time I realized, wow, Nintendo and RPGs are actually, they're not inseparable. They are very, very much separable.
Yeah, that was the end of complete domination by Nintendo over the RPG space up until that point. Because, I mean, we've talked about it all already on the NES, when I had Dragon Warrior, on the Super Nintendo, during the true golden age of Square and all of those other games. I mean, Nintendo owned RPGs, and from that point onward, Sony owned RPGs.
Yes, because it's not even like the Saturn versus the PlayStation where, okay, everyone had a little bit of something, but Nintendo had nothing for RPGs, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, all of the RPGs went to handheld. And, I mean, the Nintendo DS, we'll get to it eventually, great RPG library in many respects. Same could be said for the Nintendo 3DS, but I don't think either of them measure up to the PlayStation 2, like, not even close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the PlayStation and PlayStation 2 still, like, probably hold the championship for that.
As for the best RPG on Nintendo 64, I mean, it's kind of a grab bag. You should probably play Paper Mario.
Yeah, I would definitely give it to Paper Mario. I'm just thinking
Ogre Battle 64 is such an esoteric and kind of hard to engage with game these days. Like, I downloaded it on the Wii Virtual Console back in the day. I was like, oh, what the heck is going on with this game?
Yeah, what the heck is going on? It pretty much sums it up. I'm just, like, thinking of Quest 64 being like, woohoo, I'm the winner by default. The two greatest words in the English language.
I mean,
Paper Mario gets it.
When I was doing research, everybody was saying, Quest 64, like, what went wrong? Like, I think the obsession with it is just because it was kind of an RPG-ish game. But otherwise, it's pretty unremarkable, ultimately.
Yeah, I think unremarkable is the word that sums it up best. It wasn't necessarily, like, from what I can tell from watching videos of it, it wasn't really that offensive. It was just completely forgettable. But since it was on the N64, what else was there? So, of course, people are going to zero in on it.
Okay, that was our console RPG quest for the Nintendo 64. Do you have any feedback? Do you have any memories? Do you have any thoughts on the Nintendo 64's RPG history? And is there anything that we missed? Go ahead and send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net or send me a DM on Twitter or leave a comment on the show notes on usgamer.net. Okay, let us continue on to the mailbag. Okay, folks, last week we did a preview of all of the big RPGs that are coming out in 2020. It's going to be a huge year for RPGs. Here are what you had to say about it. Radical Defect says, I'm one of a tiny legion of people most excited to play Phantasy Star Online 2 in English for the first time after a, 8-year wait. I may literally end up buying an Xbox just for it. Getting to play a few other games I've missed from several decades of avoiding Microsoft consoles would be a nice bonus, I think. The Dreamcast and the first PSO were a huge part of my youth. Folks I played that game with when I was 13 ended up at my wedding by 30. Wow.
Aw, that's really cool.
That's amazing.
Actually, I have to point out my husband is very much looking forward to Phantasy Star Online 2. So there you go. You're not alone.
Shane Bentenhausen from 1UP was a giant PSO fan. We might have to get him on here for the Dreamcast episode.
Oh, that would be really interesting. I'd like to hear his thoughts.
Sammy J9 says, maybe it's because I've been itching to replay the original for ages, but currently my most anticipated game of 2020 is Persona 5 Royal, which is kind of funny since a game I've already played like 90% of. Same goes for Xenoblade and to a lesser extent FF7 Remake. It feels odd that I'm most excited about all these games that aren't exactly new, but on the other hand, it's going to be a year full of warm blanket comfort food games, and given how 2020 is already starting out, that sounds wonderful. That said, Bravely Default 2 will be great. I'm also hoping we may see Paper Mario. Oh, and Tales of Arise. I nearly forgot about that one. Cautiously optimistic, now that it has a much more appealing art style. Apparently an actual budget. I want to add, with Persona 5, I was taking a look at the trailers for the Persona 5 Scramble Musou game for Switch, and actually it looks pretty good.
There was actually something I tweeted a while back about how, you know, I don't really want another Musou game in my life, but I do want Persona 5's extraness in my life again. And the Musou game has that. Like, I was looking at a screen transition, just like with the person playing changed the page, and you just have this animation of Joker leaping up onto the top of the menu, and it's so ridiculous and so unnecessary, and I absolutely love it.
I like that.
So I understand
it has all of the extraness that you're just describing, and I like that it's not just fan service, because like so many of these Musou games, like Gundam and Zelda and Dragon Quest, are really just giant fan service games, right?
Yeah.
Whereas this game is an actual story. Like, it's an actual addition to Persona 5. I mean, we'll see how good that story actually is, but it makes me more interested in playing it, I think.
Yeah. I will be glad if, you know, say Atlas can't bring us Persona 5 on the Switch for whatever reason. Maybe they're like, okay, well, we'll do our best for you poor Switch owners.
And Gamer Law says, like Nadia, Bravely Default 2 tops my list for 2020. Trials of Mana remains a close second, and I will be interested to see if anything is announced for Fire Emblem, given that this year marks the 30th anniversary of the franchise.
Mm.
I was having a conversation with some friends. This is me talking, by the way, about what game would we most want to see remade from the Wii or GameCube on the Switch? And I said, I put Fire Emblem Path of Radiance on there, which was the GameCube version. I would love to play that game with upgraded graphics, maybe an upgraded art style on the Nintendo Switch. I think that would be really great.
I feel like I don't want to go backwards in Fire Emblem as long as I have three houses.
So you don't want to go back to the traditional version. Like, you want to go with this style now.
Yeah, I really like the way that Three Houses felt, but I'm also Awakening Trash, so.
Awakening Trash.
That's what I am.
And on that note, Axe the Blood God is a U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Follow me on Twitter at @T_CatBot, Nadia at Nadia Oxford. Send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net, and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter, which can be found on the front page of the website. We got lots of exciting new content coming up through the rest of January, including lots of preview opportunities that I'm really looking forward to, and some new podcasts that are going to be coming out. So please look forward to that. In the meantime, we'll be back as usual next Monday. Until then, for Nadia and myself, I've been Cat Bailey. Happy adventuring. We'll be right back.